The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right, welcome to a Tuesday. It's a brand new week here at the Nicole Sandler Show. Such as it is, we will get into it all. I'm just wanted to come in here very quickly before I officially begin the show. Sorry about my voice. to tell you that I had an equipment malfunction over the weekend and had to totally go to a new software to stream to YouTube. So YouTube, I hope this is working okay. This is my first real outing. I did some testing over the weekend. Keep your fingers crossed for me. Hopefully it'll all work smoothly. And who knows? I didn't even have to say a word. But it is the new Wirecast interface. So bear with me in case there are any technical problems. All right. Unfortunately, after this weekend, this is how we have to start the show. Take it away, Cheryl Wheeler.
Maybe it's the real crooks, maybe it's the drugs, maybe it's the parents, maybe it's the colors everybody's wearing, maybe it's the president, maybe it's the last one, maybe it's the one before that, what he done, maybe it's the high schools, maybe it's the teachers, maybe it's the tattooed children in the bleachers, maybe it's the Bible, maybe it's the lack, maybe it's the music, maybe it's the crack, maybe it's the hairdos, maybe it's the TV, maybe it's the cigarettes, maybe it's the family, maybe it's the fast food, maybe it's the news, maybe it's divorce, maybe it's abuse, maybe it's the lawyers, maybe it's the prisons, maybe it's the senators, maybe it's the system, maybe it's the fathers, maybe it's the sons, maybe it's the sisters, maybe it's the moms, maybe it's the radio, maybe it's road rage, maybe El Nino, where you feed raised, maybe it's the army, maybe it's the liquor, maybe it's the papers, maybe the militia, maybe it's the athletes, maybe it's the ads, maybe it's the sports fans, maybe it's a fad, maybe it's the magazines, maybe it's the internet, maybe it's the lottery, maybe it's the immigrants, maybe it's taxes, big business, maybe it's the KKK and the skinheads, maybe it's the communists, maybe it's the Catholics, maybe it's the hippies, maybe it's the addicts, maybe it's the art, maybe it's the sex, maybe it's the homeless, maybe it's the banks, maybe it's the clear cut, maybe it's the ozone, maybe it's the chemicals, maybe it's the car phone, maybe it's the fertilizer, maybe it's the nose rings, maybe it's the ends, but I know one thing, if it were up to me, I'd take away the guns, I'd take away the guns, I'd take away.
Her name is Cheryl Wheeler. Name is Cheryl Wheeler. And the song is If It Were Up to Me, from an album, I think, called Sylvia Hotel that came out in the late 90s. Now, somebody in the YouTube chat room just asked, Nicole, when did you first play this song? And it was actually when I was still in Los Angeles. He wrote, Rec, when did you first broadcast that anti-gun song on your show? I believe it was, I'm trying to remember when Columbine was. Hold on, let's find out. The interweb is wonderful for these things. Columbine Massacre. I believe it was 99. Yep, it was April 20th, 1999. So I believe it was the following year when the song came out. In fact, let me look that up while I'm try to type and chew gum at the same time. So I was working at a station called Channel 103.1 in Los Angeles playing music, and we played, you know, all kinds of music, songs that weren't hits. We broke them. We introduced them to the public. Then the hit music stations would pick them up and actually make them hits. Anyway, so it was a year after Sylvia Hotel. Is it not telling me? Come on, tell me what year it came out on. 1999. So it must have been later in the year, right? So it was, if I recall correctly, the one-year anniversary of the Columbine shootings. And I noticed the date, and I played that song. And I remember the response was pretty overwhelming. And there was even, somebody wrote an article in a Santa Monica, the radio station was based in Santa Monica, California. And there was an article in the local Santa Monica paper. And the reporter said, I didn't know what the song was, and I sat in the car and listened through it. And I guess I had made some remarks before I hit it about Columbine, and the disc jockey or the writer of the article, the reporter, was a little put off by what she said first, and then she played the song, and then I was floored, basically. So, and it's something that I've done for the last, I don't know, as long as I've been doing talk radio, and I started doing talk radio again around 2004, maybe. So since then, whenever there's another senseless mass shooting, I tend to open my show with this. In fact, the version I played, if you were watching on YouTube, you saw it was a video that started under the instrumental version with a bunch of photos from mass shootings. And once the lyrics kicked in, I just put the lyrics in white letters on a black screen because the lyrics are very powerful. And I put it up on YouTube so it's a shareable song so that, sure enough, when I awoke Sunday morning to the news that a second mass shooting, we were still in shock, literal shock, over what happened in El Paso on Saturday afternoon. And then I awakened Sunday morning at, 4:30, because I don't sleep well at night, to stuff on the news about Dayton, Ohio. And I just thought, this country has gone mad. So the first thing I did when I got my bearings about me was I tweeted out and posted on Facebook that YouTube version of that Cheryl Wheeler song. If it were up to me, I'd take away the guns. And so I did that. Then the second thing I did was, thinking, nothing has been done. We are so... we are in the midst of an epidemic for which no cure not only has been put on the market, there's not even a cure in development, and there should be one. So I remembered something that I've talked about many times on this show, and that was the fact that I wrote an article back in, the date I originally wrote and posted it on September 18th, 2013. The version I'm about to share with you, I updated on April 29th, 2014. And the reason was because there was yet another mass shooting. And my premise is that if killing 26 and 7-year-olds in their first grade classroom didn't make our members of Congress act to do something meaningful about guns, then nothing will. If a sitting Congress member gets shot in the head at a constituent event, as happened with Gabby Giffords, then nothing is going to make these people act. And then I started wondering, what is it that these Congress critters care about? Power and money. Two things. So I thought, well, what if we hit them in the pocketbook where it hurts? I can't hit their campaign coffers, but American tourism on a global scale is big business. Now, if all of these Congress people found the tourist dollars flowing to their states all of a sudden drying up, that might have an impact. So here was my idea. Here's what I wrote. I found a graphic. The graphic showed the mass shootings and killing incidents since Obama took office in 2009 through the time The Atlantic published an article using this graphic in September of 2013. At that time, we had just experienced yet another mass shooting. This one was at Fort Hood. And insanely, from the time that I originally posted this article in 2013 and the time that I updated it to run again in 2014, there had been another mass shooting at Fort Hood. So I wrote, the shooting at the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. on Monday marks the 20th time since Barack Obama took office that there has been a mass killing incident. Using data compiled by Mother Jones Magazine, we created an animated map to show month by month what that toll looks like. According to that data, 174 people have lost their lives since January 2009 in such incidents. The incidents must meet several criteria to be included in the Atlantic's piece in this animated map they put up. Four or more people had to have been killed in that mass shooting. It must have been a solitary shooter. The killings must have happened in a public place or series of places. I mean, the fact that they devised this map of mass shootings in the United States, an interactive map, I will put the link to this article on the blog at NicoleSandler.com. I'll actually... while we're talking, because I am a multitasker, we'll post it in the YouTube chat room and in the NicoleSandler.com chat room. Just bear with me one second. I'm doing that right now as we speak. So those links are posted there. I'll put it on the blog today at NicoleSandler.com after the show where I post the podcast. But so back to this article. I wrote, I've come to the realization that nothing will be done to stop the madness. The mass killings by crazed gunmen with weapons that serve no purpose other than to kill will continue unabated. After all, we'd already witnessed the unthinkable. And then I mentioned Gabby Giffords, and I mentioned Sandy Hook and the Newtown shootings. And then I talked to the latest carnage that I was writing about on this date, April 29th, 2014, when I said, on Monday, the crazy man with the gun killed 12 people. But they were just your everyday run-of-the-mill normal folk who ranged in age from 46 to 73. So no, they weren't babies. And no, they weren't high-ranking elected officials. If our representatives in Washington weren't moved by 20 babies' bullet-ridden bodies or by one of their own ambushed, they certainly won't be motivated by the loss of another dozen or so mere citizens whose job theirs is to protect. And then I said, obviously, the only thing that seems to matter to these politicians who are either against any sensible gun regulations, are afraid to cast the vote they know is needed, or simply haven't read the entire Second Amendment to the Constitution— is money. And by the way, that Second Amendment, for those who don't know, this is it. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. First of all, we need a rewrite of the Constitution in 21st century vernacular, because this doesn't make sense. It doesn't translate easily into the, you know, hey, dude, lexicon. Just doesn't. That aside, I honestly don't know how anyone can misconstrue a well-regulated militia. That's who they're talking about arming, not Joe Schmo down the corner having a right to a military assault weapon. That was not the intent of the First Amendment, of the Second Amendment. It just wasn't. So I continued. So I say we take it to their pocketbooks. Although the murder of Australian baseball player and college student Christopher Lane last month in Oklahoma by, quote, three bored teenagers isn't on the map of mass killings above because only one person was killed. But it was enough to prompt Australia's Deputy Prime Minister, Tim Fisher, to come on American television and warn, quote, it is another example of murder mayhem on Main Street. People thinking of going to the USA for business or tourist trips should think carefully about it, given the statistical fact that you are 15 times more likely to be shot dead in the USA than in Australia per capita. Did you get that? Sorry, the ding was very low. Ding. Yes, 15 times more likely to be shot dead in the USA than in Australia per capita. And that doesn't apply only to Australia. Again, the data in this article that I originally published 6 years ago is probably a little outdated. Unfortunately, the numbers are only going to be worse. But in this chart that I have that was published by the Washington Post the day after the Newtown massacre clearly shows that the United States is by far the gun-killing capital of the world. There's the U.S. It says firearm homicides per 100,000 people. The U.S. has a big red line that's up to over three. So it looks like about 325,000. All right, it's firearm homicides per 100,000 people, and it's about 3.25. The next one on the list is Chile, which comes in a little over 2, followed by Turkey, that's between 0.5 and 1, and it goes downhill from there. Turkey, Switzerland, Belgium, Italy, Bulgaria, Ireland, Canada, Sweden, Finland, Portugal, and now we are below 0.5%. The United States has by far the highest per capita rate of all developed countries, bar none. That's just the way it is, baby. The U.S. gun murder rate is about 20 times the average for all other countries. And this is on a chart that's, you know, what, 8 years old already? Lovely. So that information makes the case that the United States is not the best choice when citizens of other nations are planning their vacations. After all, why go somewhere where you're 20% more likely to be killed by a crazy person with a gun than to a country where you're likely to be much safer? You see, that would hurt our pocketbook. Wouldn't that be a shame? Then I have some statistics from the International Business Times and from World Travel and Tourism Council about United States tourism rate. And industry. Here, from listen to this. Travel and tourism's total contribution to the GDP in the Americas was $1.9 trillion in 2011, or 8.6% of the total GDP. This compares to 6% for automotive and mining and 7% for chemicals. So tourism is big money here in the U.S. In fact, here's more stats for you. Growth in tourism spending has mostly stayed higher than GDP growth since about mid-2010, according to Bureau data. In early 2011, tourism spending rose by about 10%, while GDP growth stayed at 2% or lower. So again, tourism brings a lot of dollars, international dollars, to the U.S., and even more so for each individual state. Their coffers are truly enriched by international tourism. So I wrote, hit them where it hurts. If the politicians can just step over all the dead bodies in the road, let's see how they react to huge monetary losses their corporate benefactors will suffer. Once the U.S. Chamber of Commerce steps in, maybe they'll actually do something. And on that post, I included an interview that I did with the former Deputy Prime Minister of Australia. His name is Tim Fisher. He was in office when the 1996 Port Arthur massacre happened in Australia. It's their one and only mass shooting, a massacre. And they, just like New Zealand did a few months ago, they jumped into action. And within 6 months, they had changed the laws. They enacted a gun buyback program. They have not had a single mass shooting since. So my thought is, once again, I resurrected it. I tweeted out a link to this article on Sunday morning, and I put it out there. Every civilized nation on the planet should should issue a travel advisory to their citizens and just say simply, the United States is not safe. Use your travel dollars wisely and think about going somewhere else until the United States gets its shit together and gets those goddamn guns off the streets. So imagine my surprise when, this is from this morning, right? Yesterday, someone direct messaged me an article on Twitter, and I saw others today. Let me just read you the article that came to me yesterday. The headline reads, "Foreign countries are warning their citizens about U.S. travel after mass shootings." Okay, I don't even need the credit for it. Just make it be. Make it so. Here's the article. Foreign nations are warning their citizens that traveling in the United States could put them at risk of becoming a victim of a mass shooting. A statement Monday from Uruguay's foreign minister warned about, quote, growing indiscriminate violence in the U.S. It urged Uruguayans traveling there to avoid theme parks, shopping centers, festivals, religious events, gastronomic fairs, and any kind of cultural or sporting events. What else is there? U.S. authorities are unable to prevent mass shootings because of indiscriminate gun ownership, the statement said. Venezuela. Their foreign minister released a similar statement, also warning its citizens to avoid large gatherings where mass shootings might occur. The Japanese consul in Detroit on Sunday published an alert that said Japanese nationals, quote, should be aware of the potential for gunfire incidents everywhere in the United States, which described it as a, quote, gun society. The advisories come after two deadly shootings and the attacks in the U.S. in the span of less than 24 hours, and it goes on from there. Foreign countries have issued warnings in the past about the propensity of mass shootings in the U.S., including France, New Zealand, and Germany. And El Paso police said yesterday that one of the victims in the Walmart attack was a German citizen. So that's my idea. Again, I just posted the link to both of the chat rooms, the YouTube and the NicoleSandler.com chat room. So please feel free to share. It's out on Twitter. It's on Facebook. I want this idea to spread far and wide, and it looks like it's already taking hold. Hit them where it hurts. Hit them in the pocketbook. All right. Now I got that out of the way. You know, it's Tuesday, and on Tuesdays, we usually hang out with Gotta Laugh. And for a number of reasons, I really love Tuesdays. Laffy's a dear friend. You know the really hard times I've been going through in the last, couple of years, really. But, you know, over the last year, I had a bit of a meltdown, a breakdown, whatever you want to call it. I'm feeling my way back. As you know, I still have my moments. I have a meltdown every now and again. Well, I'm not the only one. I mean, I hear from so many listeners who, although I get horribly embarrassed when I do break down, I know that being real is appreciated. I've heard from so many listeners saying, thank you so much for sharing with us your emotional fragility, because I'm going through the same exact thing. And at least with you, I know I'm not alone. I got to tell you, you are so not alone. And right now, Laffy's having a bit of a thing. She's having a difficult time, and she just needed to take some time off. So she's not here today, and we'll play each subsequent week by ear. But, you know, give Laffy a shout out on Twitter. I know she would love to hear from you. She's okay. It's too much stress. There's too much pressure coming from all angles. So she's just backing off a little bit and trying not to put pressure on herself. And believe me, I know exactly how it is. So Laffy's not here today, but let me tell you who we have coming up in her stead. I was thinking, well, maybe I should get somebody on guns. You think? Well, we've done, I don't know how many shows we've done on guns and gun control. We had Igor Volsky of Think Progress, who had a wonderful book out not too long ago about guns. I had Tom Hartman on the show a few weeks ago, who's got a brand new book out about guns. But I was thinking, who can comment on what brought us to this place, how we got here, the hatred, the insanity? And I'm not talking about only mental illness. I'm talking about the insanity of the world at large. I'm not only talking about human mental illness. I'm talking about our planet is sick. And yes, I believe our planet has a mental illness. And I thought this, at least the El Paso shooting, all goes back to racism. And I think the reason the incidences of what appear to be racially motivated shootings are on the rise is because we have a certified racist in the White House. The man is a fucking bigot. All right, obviously I didn't, we're coming close to the bottom of the hour, and I have to get Tim Wise, one of the most amazing men who writes about, talks about, educates about racism in America, is going to join us. And so he's standing by. So I'm going to get him. But one thing I wanted to tell, what did I want to get to before? I don't like to play Donald Trump sound, and I don't do it very often. But this is really important because this idiot. All right. So yesterday he said, at 10 o'clock, Donald Trump is going to deliver a message about the shooting. It's like the best thing he could do is keep his mouth shut because he's already done so much damage, right? But no, he spoke. So we know what happened, right? 31 people were killed over the weekend in two shootings. At 10:30 Saturday morning, a lone gunman entered the Walmart in El Paso, Texas, and unloaded a torrent of bullets into the bodies of random people shopping for back-to-school supplies. This guy killed 22 people and injured at least 26 more. Police said they found an anti-immigrant document espousing white nationalist and racist views, which they believe was written by the suspect. He apparently uploaded it to 8chan, maybe 15 minutes before the shooting. Police say he may face hate crime charges in addition to capital murder charges. So this is this guy. And then it was 13 hours later, at 1 a.m. Sunday morning, another gunman opened fire in a Dayton, Ohio entertainment district, killing 9 people, including his sister, before meeting his demise. Now, so Donald Trump said, all right, he's going to deliver remarks from one room in the White House, whatever. He was trying but failing to look presidential. Right? He tried. He looked serious. He just looked like an idiot standing there with that stupid yellow-colored hair and the orange shit on his face and his artificially whitened teeth. And he delivered prepared remarks. And he surprised critics by reading certain words off the teleprompter.
In one voice, our nation must condemn racism, bigotry, and white supremacy.
Wow. All right, that's interesting. But, you know, and he went on. I'm not going to burden you with the rest of it. But he said those words, which, shocker. But the thing is, it doesn't comport with the Donald Trump, who has spread nothing but bigotry, racism, xenophobia, and other kinds of phobias since appearing on that escalator 4 years ago to launch his ridiculous presidential campaign. So Dump, yesterday, attempted to appear as a consoler-in-chief to widespread criticism and mockery. And his speech, read from a teleprompter, as usual, the level of a third grader delivering a book report that he wrote by, you know, copying off of Cliff Notes, and as would be respected, he blamed everyone but himself. He blamed the internet. He blamed video games and mental illness. But though he did actually take the step to call out the homegrown hatred here, obviously it was written on the script. And, you know, it sounded sincere, I suppose. Again, I'm not going to play it because we're short on time, and I don't want to assault your ears. But, you know, this is the same guy who also tweeted out thoughts and prayers for the people. Tweeted out thoughts and prayers, and then at the end of his speech, he gave his sincere thoughts and prayers for the people of El Paso, and I know he meant Dayton. Toledo?
We will ensure that those who were attacked will not have died in vain. May God bless the memory of those who perished in Toledo. May God protect them.
Did you hear that? Hold on. I was reading something, but he said Toledo!
Perished in Toledo?
Nobody perished in Toledo! It was Dayton, Ohio. Dayton. Dayton, Ohio, and that idiot, that moron, that walking thing that's occupying the White House, the Oval Office, said Toledo. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out the other gaffe. That one from Joe Biden, who at a fundraiser on Sunday night almost immediately spoke of the two recent mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton, at first referring to them as, quote, the tragic events in Houston today and also in Michigan the day before. What? Come on, Joe.
Go to Joe 30330.
I mean, really, Houston and Michigan? That's worse than Dayton, I'll just say. I have no words. There's one other thing, but I'm late to get to Tim Wise. So let's get Tim Wise on the line. I do have an issue with Joe Biden. It might have to wait till tomorrow. All right. I don't want to wait any longer because, again, Tim Wise is waiting for our call. Tim Wise, in case you don't know, is an author. Well, he's so much more than that. He's one of the most prominent anti-racist writers and educators in the United States. Tim Wise has spent the last 25 years speaking to audiences all over the country. He's written 7 books, the latest of which is called Under the Affluence, Shaming the Poor, Praising the Rich, and Sacrificing the Future of America. And he's also the host of a new podcast, Speak Out, with Tim Wise. You can find him on Twitter at Tim Jacob Wise. You can visit his website at timwise.org. And I'm thrilled that he's here with us now. Hey, Tim.
Hey, how are you?
I've been better. I don't recognize this place anymore. And it's one of those weird transitions that we've been living through. There's always been racism in this country. There's always been hatred in this country. It seems like it's been like a slow moving coup. Many people have talked about this slow descent into fascism. Well, I think the slow descent back into hatred, back into a racist society, maybe started with, had the opposite of Barack Obama's election, maybe had the opposite effect, where people like me thought we have really taken a giant step in getting to a post-racial era. But it maybe the undercurrent was racism just bubbling up and building stronger than before. Am I off base with that?
Well, I think that on the one hand, we just need to understand the historical trajectory of what we're seeing right now. You know, Carol Anderson, the brilliant scholar at Emory, wrote a book a couple years back called White Rage. And the thesis of the book, which she spells out very clearly and very succinctly, is that in every period of American history where black folks in particular, but I think you could extrapolate that to people of color more broadly, have either made significant strides or have had certain symbolic progress that is perceived to be quite significant, even if maybe it's not as significant as we'd like, it has led to a kind of backlash. It has led to white rage, a reaction of extreme rage at the sort of equalization, even if it's not completely equal, of the society. And so we saw that after the end of enslavement. We saw that after the end of segregation. We saw that when black folks moved to the North during the Great Migration in the early part of the 20th century. We saw that after the civil rights movement and affirmative action, and we saw that after the election of Barack Obama. Putting aside, you know, whether those individual strides, including certainly the election of Obama, really moved the ball forward that much, it certainly was perceived by a lot of white America, right, as this groundswell shift, for good or for bad. Some mm-hmm. of us thought it was for good. A lot of white folks, as we know, didn't think it was. Well. And so, in a sense, what we're seeing is part of the inevitable growing pains of a country becoming what it professes to be, a pluralistic, multicultural democracy. That's not to say, oh, well, we just got to accept this, you know, white racial terrorism, but we shouldn't be surprised by it because it has literally marked every era. The question is not whether we ought to be shocked. We certainly shouldn't be. It's keeping with our history. The question is, how do we respond in this moment? Do we shrink from the challenge? Or do we lean into that challenge and continue to push forward, knowing that it's either moving forward or it's going back? There's not going to be any standing still. We are either going to become our country, that is to say, the country that we were taught that we had, that we never had, or we are going to descend into something that we have seen before. We have seen racial fascism in this country. It's certainly not new. We've lived it for most of our history. And even today, as we may be able to say that we're not a fascist place with regard to race, we are certainly a white supremacist place indirectly and directly in many ways. And we don't want to descend back into that. But what we're seeing right now is not really new. It is a just a different iteration of something that's been going on really from the beginning of this country and even the colonial period.
Do you believe that, and I do, just to put it out there, that a lot of these attitudes had been simmering, just simmering sort of under the surface? And, you know, and then Barack Obama was elected, and a lot of that anger started bubbling up a little more, but it was still under the surface. And with the arrival of Donald Trump and his, right, his sickening racism on display, his bigotry, the way he talks to people, everything about his mannerisms and the way he speaks, took the cover off and said, free to be who you are, be as ugly, as racist, as misogynistic, as, you know, anti-Semitic as you want. Like, all the controls are off, because it seemed like there was this huge shift where some doors flew open and all the ugliness escaped and it now is all around us.
I mean, the thing is that for 40 years, the reactionary right in this country and the conservative movement more broadly in this country had been willing to strike this sort of grand bargain with the public. That is to say, we will not be so obvious. We will dog whistle our racism. We're still going to appeal to racial resentment and racial anxiety. We're going to talk about busing, and we're going to talk about welfare, and we're going to talk about crime in the cities, and we're going to talk about reverse discrimination. We're going to use all these buzz phrases. And look, the Republicans admitted at one point that this is what they were doing. I mean, Lee Atwater, famously, you know, Republican operative in 1981, is caught on tape. You can, you know, Google this and folks can listen to it. He says in a recording in 1981 that what we, meaning the GOP, had been doing since the 60s was learning that you can't use the N-word in public, you can't say these things publicly, it gets you in trouble. So we're going to start using these abstract concepts like taxes and welfare and crime and busing. But really what we're doing is we're hurting black people more than we're hurting white people. And it was clearly for political purpose. What Trump did and what Trumpism does is it rips up that bargain. It basically says, to hell with that, we're going to grab our nuts, pardon the expression, politically speaking, and we're going to go back to doing what we used to do the way it used to be, when we didn't have to worry about whether we offended you, you know. And so they had all the signs at the Trump rallies, you know, F your feelings and all this, you know, and sort of this idea that we just want to be able to sit in the chair and fart and burp our racism and go back to the way it was, because we don't believe it, you know, that couched it. We just don't want to be politically correct, but really they want to be assholes again, you know, it's making America trash again.
Right.
And so, I don't know which is better. I mean, listen, there's nothing to be said positive about the dog whistle, because a lot of damage was done under the aegis of the dog whistle. You know, we got the crime bill because of the dog whistle.
Right.
We got really awful bipartisan welfare reform because of the dog whistle. We got a Supreme Court hostile to a lot of affirmative action and racial civil rights policies during the period of the dog whistle. So I don't want to necessarily say that was a grand old time, but I do want to suggest that it does tell us something, and not something good, about where we are, that people don't even feel the need to pretend anymore. That is frightening,
it
obviously. You have to grapple with what that means.
It is. And seeing the extent to which the man in the White House goes, how deep down into the ugly he goes and acts like it's all okay. I mean, and you've written about this and talked about it a lot. One need go back no further than Charlottesville and him equating Nazis marching and saying Jews will not replace us. And Klan members, you know, in their full Klan regalia, all, and Donald Trump says, oh, there were very fine people on both sides.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and it's important to set the record very clear and straight on this, you know, because the right is very busy trying to gaslight the country as to what their president said and what he meant. And so there's this video going around, you know, this PragerU, Prager University, which is not a university, of course. If it was, it would be about as legitimate as Trump University, started by Dennis Prager, this, you know, ridiculous moralist who apparently decided morals didn't matter when it came to the presidency of Donald Trump. And so they send out all these absurd propaganda videos. This one that they've just released called the Charlottesville Lie says that Donald Trump didn't say what we all heard him say. He wasn't talking about the Nazis. He wasn't talking about the Klan. He was talking about the people that were there just to defend the Robert E. Lee statue. A couple of points, very important. Number one, there was no one there simply to defend the statue. Literally, right. There was no, no one. I mean, this event was not called the Unite the People to Defend the Robert E. Lee Statue Rally. It was Unite the Right. It was promoted, and all of the PR material was promoted by white nationalists. All the speakers who were supposed to be on the speakers list mm-hmm. that day were white supremacists, wow. neo-Nazis, overt mm-hmm. fascists. This was not, there's not a single, and the reason we know this, there's not a single mainstream conservative who went to this thing. If this were not a Nazi rally, a white supremacist rally, don't you figure some mainstream conservative Republicans would have probably shown up? I mean, yeah. you know, if it was just about the statues, you would have had some mainstream, you would have had some historians show up. They didn't. This was entirely a white supremacist event. And here's the thing, if I'm wrong, and there were, in fact, individuals who maybe were naive, right? I mean, that's possible. Mm-hmm. Could have been individuals that were naive and showed up thinking it was just about the statues. But here's the thing. If you're actually a very fine person and you show up and you realize, holy shit, I'm surrounded by Nazis, what does a very fine person do? A very fine person
gets the fuck out.
gets in their car and leaves. Or they go to the nearest, you know, television reporter and they go, oh, my God, I feel so silly. I got duped. This is terrible. And I try to put distance between myself and them, and I condemn them. Well, not one person who went to this thing, who was supposedly a very fine person, did that. If they were there, they stayed. If they were there, they marched alongside those folks. And I'm sorry, if you come for innocent reasons, but you stay surrounded by Nazis, you're no better than Nazis. And
exactly.
One more final point.
Right.
One more final point. I don't believe it is possible, and this is, you know, people can maybe disagree with me on this. I don't think it is possible to be a very fine person and come to defend the Robert E. Lee statue. And here's why I say that. I'm not saying that every person who sort of, you know, respects Confederate history is automatically the equivalent of a Nazi or an overt white supremacist. But those statues, let's understand the history. The Robert E. Lee statue and all these Confederate statues across the South and even sometimes outside the South, they are not the equivalent of history textbooks. They are not historically accurate markers. They are worship altars for people who want to resurrect the lost cause of the Confederacy. They lie about the purpose of the Confederacy, mm-hmm. even though the Confederate leaders said at the time that the only reason they broke away from the Union was to preserve slavery and white supremacy. That's their words, not mine. It's what they admitted. So when you go to defend statuary for that cause, you are, in fact, standing up for white supremacy. And if you don't know that then, you know that now. And all of the history says so. So if you want to put those statues in a museum, I have no problem.
Right.
But they are worship altars. They are intended for people to come and drink of the blood and eat of the flesh of their great-great-grandpappy Tudor so that they can remember the blessed cause of the South. The mm-hmm. cause of the South was not blessed, it was not noble, it was wretched, and the people who fought for it ought not be remembered in this glorification kind of way. They ought to be remembered as the traitors and the racists that they were, period. And anybody who rallies for that purpose is just as bad as they were.
Amen. You're listening to Tim Wise, who's got one of the most appropriate names of anybody I know, because he is. His website is timwise.org. From there, you can find out about his books and his podcast and any speaking engagements. But this is what Tim Wise does. He speaks about racism and from an anti-racism point of view. It seemed, again, and we've been talking for well over a decade, Tim. I've been honored to have you on my show throughout the years, and talked about, and it seemed for the longest time that we were getting past so many of these issues, and maybe that was my white privilege and my lack of living through, you know, seeing life through the eyes of an African American. I you know, have a different reality, but just by virtue of being a white woman. Are things actually getting worse, or is it just the everything that's been percolating underneath coming to the surface because we've got a bigot and a racist in the White House?
Well, like I said, I just think, you know, history goes in these sort of cycles when it comes to race. And so the history of race in this country is the history of people of color leading freedom and liberation movements, getting some victories, some important progress, and then this white rage, as Carol Anderson calls it, in response, which oftentimes takes us back a couple of steps. And then people of color and their white allies potentially, hopefully, join together and fight for more progress. And then we get a couple steps more forward, and then, you know, there's backlash again. So I want people to understand that and put it in perspective, because otherwise I fear that we get sidetracked and we start thinking, oh my God, like, you know, the wheels are coming off the bus. Look, the bus has always had some really flat tires on this thing called America. And I think if we get freaked out by the backlash and don't understand, it's entirely predictable. Nothing that is happening right now is particularly shocking, for instance, to people of color. The election of Donald Trump itself did not shock black and brown folks. They might not have been happy about it, but they weren't surprised that it was possible. On the other hand, an awful lot of white folks, including white liberal and progressive folks, I think were truly stunned that this could happen. You know, I have on my pinned tweet on my Twitter page, which is at Tim Jacob, or at Tim Jacob Wise.
Right.
Is a tweet of it's a meme of James Baldwin, and I'm going to pull it up right now so I can read it to folks. It's a picture of Baldwin, the amazing author whose birthday was just the other day. Actually, it would have been 95 years old.
Wow.
And the quote on there is something about. Hold on, I'm trying to pull it up.
It always happens that way, doesn't it?
I know, I hate that. Trying to do too many things.
Yeah, and new Twitter. New Twitter is giving me problems, or I would have pulled it up for you, but go ahead.
In 1962, Baldwin said this, and this is my pen tweet at Tim Jacob Watts. White people were and are astounded by the Holocaust in Germany. They did not know that they could act that way, but I very much doubt whether black people were astounded. Right? In other words, what he was saying was there is this innocence, this naivete that so many white folks have about just what we're capable of. And you see it with these mass shootings. That's why all these folks on the right are having such a hard time accepting that the politics and the rhetoric of Donald Trump lead to these kind of things, because they just don't think that they could possibly be like that. They don't believe it. That's why they think all the, you know, all the Cesar Sayoc, the guy with the MAGA van sending the bomb, well, it must have been a false flag. No Trump person would do that.
Oh, my
you know,
God.
Rush Limbaugh, when all that was going on, Limbaugh said bombing, that's something only left-wingers do. Well, yeah, I guess if you forget Timothy McVeigh,
right,
and Terry Nichols, and Eric Rudolph, and all, you know, I mean, you know, or all the people that have set bombs at abortion clinics, all of whom were right-wingers. Like, there's this denialism. And I was thinking about this the other day, and I was driving to New Orleans, and I was listening to a podcast, really great podcast called White Lies, which is a podcast about the killing of James Reeb and Selma, a civil rights activist and
minister
from Boston, Unitarian minister. And he went down there and he was murdered during the whole period in March when Bloody Sunday happened. And the podcast is talking about how the people of Selma, the white folks of Selma, convinced themselves in 1965, and many still believe today, that none of theirs did that, that James Reeb wasn't murdered by a racist white person and a mob on the streets of Selma, that rather he was hit. Yeah, there was a white guy that hit him, but then they put him in the ambulance and his own friend, either black folks or the other white ministers that were with him, they killed him in the ambulance just so the civil rights movement could have a white martyr. They literally believed this and still do. The National Review, which then and now, you know, then it was the conservative magazine, the primary, you know, journalistic organ of the far right. Now it's one among many. But National Review, after the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in 1963 in Birmingham, actually said that there was good reason to believe that black folks in Birmingham had bombed their own church, killed those four little girls deliberately, just to discredit the noble cause of white segregationists. This was William F. Buckley's publication saying this. So this is a long history of white Americans not being willing to look at the evil that some of our number do. And then we wonder why black and brown folks don't trust our commitment to racial equity. And we're shocked that we continue to have a problem getting past this issue. Well, you know, if we would decide to actually look in the mirror and acknowledge the cost of white supremacy, not only to people of color, but to ourselves, because when you deny the obvious, you make a monster of yourself. You know, when you profess innocence long after innocence has been delivered stillborn, you make a monster. And that's where we are right now. and we see it, I think, every day. And it comes a point where you just have to stop arguing with these people and trying to convince them that water comes from the sky.
Right.
You know,
right.
And that ice is cold. I mean, you just can't. You just have to move forward, and you just have to steamroll them.
Right.
There comes a point you can't waste your time trying to convince cult members that the cult is evil. You just
right.
have
so,
to, you have to
right. So we find out that the shooter from Saturday put out this manifesto of sorts. I read some of it, sadly. And so we know what his motivations were, or allegedly. And we find out that not only he, but the shooter in New Zealand, and the one, I think, just last week in Gilroy, that they post these manifestos on an internet board called 8chan, which I believe has now been taken down, that this is sort of a hangout for these white supremacist people. And they put their, you know, their world domination ideas and their murderous manifestos online there. So he posted it just 15 minutes before he went and murdered 22 people. Is the internet helping? Is it the connecting of these people that makes them so dangerous? Because when they were all left to their own, you know, devices, I guess they still found each other. Look, you know, Oklahoma City happened before the internet. Maybe it's easier now for them to find one another, and that's why it's more dangerous?
Well, it certainly is easier as a recruiting tool and a radicalization tool. You know, the internet, on the one hand, can be a fantastic tool for progressive folks to get an anti-racist message out. It's much easier for me to do the work I do now, for instance, than it was 20 or 25 years ago. But on the flip side of that, it also is easier for Nazis to spread their information. And for these guys, and it is mostly guys, not exclusively, but for these guys who hang out on the chans, or they hang out on Reddit, and they post, you know, these are guys, I mean, to be perfectly honest, they're disproportionately young men who are sitting around in their parents' basement, yeah, binge eating Cool Ranch Doritos and Hot Pockets. And they're not paying their own bills. They're not, you know, they can't interact with actual human beings in the real world. They live online. They complain about how they can't get laid. They're
yep.
stunned.
Oh, they're incels, around. Of course. We learned all about the incels. Right.
Stunned that no woman will have them.
Of course.
You know, I mean, this is shocking. And so they nurture one another's hatreds and resentments. And I think it is time for us to view these places, not just as these sort of places of protected speech that just so happen to house the worst human beings on the internet, but as places that are indeed recruiting tools where real terrorist plots are being hatched. And we ought to treat these folks no differently than we would treat anyone else who was, you know, hatching terrorist plots. There's no way that if you were ISIS talking about this stuff online, that somebody wouldn't know about it, that somebody wouldn't be monitoring. And I realize we talk about government monitoring of this stuff, it can get real dicey, and I don't believe that you ought to prevent people from spewing even really awful, shitty beliefs. But when it crosses that line to where you're talking about active threats, there is nothing about the First Amendment that protects making threats against people violently, threatening to kill people or rape people, which is the kind of stuff you see on 8chan all the time.
Right.
So whether it's government pressure or whether it's private pressure, we should be applying consumer pressure to keep these websites offline. To anybody that gives them a server, we ought to destroy their business model. Anybody that gives them protection from DDoS attacks and keeps their websites online, we ought to destroy their business model. It's time to apply financial pressure and wreck these folks, because there is no First Amendment right to have a particular web server or particular service online. You have the right to stand on the corner and be an asshole if you want to be an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're hiding in your parents' basement doing it online, you only have the courage of your convictions to come out in public and say that stuff, because you know somebody will knock you on your ass. Well, it's time for us as a society to knock these people on their ass and take away their little toys. And they can sit around playing video games and looking at anime porn instead, you know, find some other hobby.
Without a doubt. And that's what they should be doing. But they're empowered by this administration. Donald Trump spoke to the American people yesterday. He was obviously reading off a teleprompter and words somebody else wrote, except I think he ad-libbed the Dayton part. I mean, the Toledo,
right.
The Toledo
read.
Part.
I mean,
no,
he
can't read.
Cannot read.
Right. So, but he said, he actually said the words. He said, what? He said, domestic
voice.
Terrorism.
Our nation must condemn racism.
Racism.
Bigotry.
Bigotry.
And white supremacy.
Oh, my God. And white supremacy. Now, it must have taken everything to get him to read those words.
Sniffing. Then he did that sniffing thing that he always does when he's not being sincere. It's like a tell. You know, he has this tick that only coke addicts and liars have.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so assuming he's not a cokehead, he's clearly lying. I mean, I was waiting for him to start, you know, batting his eyelids like in Morse code the way that POWs used to during the Vietnam War to let you know, I don't really mean this shit. I'm just making it up. Like, leave my eyes.
Uh-huh.
You know? Because it was like a hostage situation. It's like somebody had a gun to his head and said, denounce racism. He's like, oh, Jesus, if I have to, all right, you know.
Yeah, oh, exactly. And maybe the sniffs were his Morse code.
Yeah, that was the subtle hint to, like, the Richard Spencers of the world. Like, they're making me, the Jews are making me say, my daughter and my son-in-law are making me say this. I hate this.
And what about him? You know, saying God bless the victims in Toledo? Do you think that was on the teleprompter, or was this him going off script and not knowing that it was Dayton and not Toledo?
I there was a picture I saw which purported to be from the side and back of him that showed the teleprompter, and if it was a genuine picture, it could have been doctored.
Right.
But if it was genuine, Toledo is nowhere on there. And here's what's sad. You know, Ohio is a state that Donald Trump is expected to win in 2020, but doesn't even know where this happened. If I was a white Daytonian, it would be like, even if I was someone that leaned in his direction, I'd be like, dude, we just had this tragedy, and you can't even be bothered to remember where it happened. I mean, it's just, and if Obama had said Toledo instead of Dayton, and
impeach him. Oh. Yeah. No, it would have been.
I mean, you know, but the fact that he read it, again, you know, we know there's teleprompter Trump and there's rally Trump. And I'll tell you what, I dare Donald Trump to say those words at one of his MAGA rallies. I dare him to look at that rabid white opponent and say, I renounce racism, bigotry and white supremacy, and we all should do that. If one of two things, number one, he's not going to do it.
No.
But number two, if he did it, you know damn good and well that the applause for that would be very muted. It would be that sort of polite applause, like, what the hell just happened
here?
It's not going to be anywhere near the applause he gets if he says, send them back or build the wall or some other, you know, they'll scream and yell about that. But if he were to say, oh, by the way, let's renounce racism and white supremacy, they would just go, oh, okay, can we get back to the wall, please?
Yeah.
You know, because that's
sort of dark. Right. So I think Donald Trump has brought out the ugliest that America has to offer. And he's emboldening these hateful people to say, because they believe, you know, it's okay. Even little kids are reporting being bullied at school because, hey, the president says it's okay. Can we turn this around, do you think, if the left is organized enough and does the right thing and comes out to vote in droves next November, and we vote him out of office, and if we're able to actually evict him and get him out of the White House, can we get back to some semblance of where we were before and start moving ahead again?
Well, clearly where we were before wasn't good enough either. We have to move forward.
Right, and move ahead,
The thing that concerns me is there are probably several strategies that can lead to victory, if by victory we define that as just, you know, beating Trump. I think there are a lot of paths to that. I think it's possible to beat him by a handful of electoral votes and 5-6 million, you know, popular votes like last time.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is that I just don't think that's enough. Defeating Trump, the man, is not going to be sufficient. We really, this defeat has to be a renunciation of Trumpism. And the only way that happens is with a massive defeat, because the closer it is, a couple things happen. One is he'll be able to say that it was stolen from him, and his cult will be more likely to believe it if it's a handful of electoral votes. Like, for instance, if the Democrats were to win by the total of votes, like 70,000 that he won by in those three key states of Michigan, Wisconsin, and PA, that's just not going to be enough. He'll say it was stolen.
Yep.
And even if ultimately he has to abdicate, you know, he'll still be able, his cult will still be enraged. And I really worry at that point about the violence people see if they believe it's been taken from them. So it needs to be a repudiation. That means we've got to have not just progressive base voters.
Everybody.
We've got to have all Republicans who swear they aren't with him.
Yep.
They can't stay at home. They've got to go vote for a Democrat, no matter what that means to them, if they really want to put the stake in the ground here and defeat not just the vampire, so to speak, but but the whole brood that is back at the Vampire's Place, if you know what I mean.
Without a doubt. Tim Wise, I hope everyone is hearing what you're saying. And we've got a whole year and then some to ratchet up that message, because we got to drown them out. Tim Wise, again, find him at timwise.org. Check out his podcast. Read some of his books. Go hear him speak. I'm very lucky that he comes on this show. Tim Wise, thank you so much.
You bet.
Always appreciate it. Take care. Bye-bye. All right, and that does it for today. We'll be back tomorrow on the program. The wonderful, the one, the only Harvey J.K. returns. He's got a few words to say about, you know, the election and Trump and the debates and all that. So Harvey's back. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everyone. Keep the faith, baby.